Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and it's been a very busy week. We, as you know, we had our annual dinner this week, but we heard that the Premier of Western Australia was in town, and we grabbed at the opportunity to hear from Colin Barnett. I'll introduce him very briefly. He studied economics at the University of Western Australia, held a number of positions, entered Parliament in 1990, held many senior positions, including in the period of the Court government. Mr. Barnett was the Deputy Liberal Leader in the Coalition Government, and held key ministerial responsibilities, including resources and energy, and for a time, education, among others. But of course, most importantly, he was elected the Premier of Western Australia in 2008, and it's our 20th anniversary last week, and it's the Premier's first anniversary next Sunday. So congratulations, Premier. And the Premier's going to talk for us on Over the Nullarbor, Over the Horizon. Many thanks for coming.
Thank you very much, Jared, for that introduction, and can I thank all of you for the opportunity to address the Sydney Institute. I am conscious that this is the week of the 20th anniversary of the Institute, and it has been an important forum for ideas and for debate in Australia. So thank you and congratulations. The topic of my address, Over the Nullarbor and Over the Horizon, says something about Western Australia. It is a long way away, and it is different. We don't have pokies, we don't have daylight saving, and we don't have toll roads. But there are some more fundamental structural differences between Western Australia and its economy and Australia in the broad. I intend to say a little bit about the last state election. I'd like to then say a little about some major issues of big projects and state development, and then some comments, as I see them, relating to our relationship with China. First, in terms of the last state election in Western Australia. As you may know, I had made a decision to leave politics, and I was quite comfortable in that decision. I'd had a good run, I'd been deputy leader, I'd been a minister for 8 years in the portfolios that I went into politics to be involved in, that is the mining, petroleum industry, and as well a period in education, which I thoroughly enjoyed. The Labor government under Alan Carpenter had some problems, some serious problems, and had lost the respect of many people in the West Australian community. The Liberals had had three leaders in 3 years, and there had been some fairly well-publicised, what I describe as off-field incidents. In the lead-up, the then-leader Troy Buswell made a decision to stand down. I discouraged him from that decision, but he decided that he would stand down, that it was the best thing to do. As a result of that, I was essentially drafted back from my imminent departure from politics. I did so willingly, but with some conditions. I thought at that stage we had a rough chance, maybe a 40% chance of winning an election. I said I wanted absolute loyalty, absolute commitment to doing it. Otherwise, I wasn't interested. There was nothing in itself to attract me back into that role. I got that. Even from some people in the party that hadn't always been close to me, did their job and did it superbly. I became the leader of the Liberal Party in Western Australia on the 6th of August. Alan Carpenter called an election on the 7th of August. At the time, I was buying a new suit. Having come back into the leadership, I thought I'd run down my wardrobe. I thought I'd better actually buy at least one new suit. I was with my tailor, and I said, make it two. It ended up three, because the news broke when I was with him. And we were straight into an election campaign. The election had been called 6 months early, and right at the start of the Beijing Olympics. That worked against Labor and worked in favour of the Liberal Party. People saw it as being less than honest, of cheating, un-Australian, lacking sportsmanship. And I certainly played on that throughout the election campaign for what it was worth. And particularly during the Olympics, of all events, when that epitomises sportsmanship and the idea of a fair go, here was an election called, very cynically, 6 months early, for no reason, no valid reason at all. Labor spent a lot of money advertising during that election period. All it did was irritate people. With the interest in the Olympics, you can imagine perhaps your annoyance if you saw a political advertisement coming on just before the 100-metre sprint. People didn't like it, they were aggravated and annoyed by it. I campaigned on many issues, but I had a fundamental theme, and that was that I would, if elected, lead a government of honesty and integrity. And I brought back into the Liberal ranks an independent, Dr. Liz Constable, who has a Joan of Arc status, and quite deservedly in West Australian politics, an outstanding person, conservative, independent, and she stood by my side every time I talked about honesty and integrity, and is now a minister in our government. Still an independent, but very much on the conservative side of politics. The campaign did have the basis of a change of government. The Labor Party had sacked or had resigned five ministers during the term. All sorts of inquiries and hearings before the Corruption and Crime Commission. They had failed in several key areas of policy. And there was a sense in the community they had wasted the opportunity of a preceding economic boom. As the Liberal leader, we presented policy differences. We did have policy, more than perhaps the media anticipated. We campaigned on some easily understood issues. On law and order, we had a simple key policy, a message to the community that if you assault a police officer causing bodily harm, you will go to jail. And that legislation is about to be law. We also had a policy to retain the older hospital, Royal Perth Hospital, in the centre of Perth. It serves as all central city hospitals do. Many people from disadvantaged backgrounds, many lonely people, many elderly people. And that has been done. We supported uranium mining, long-standing position of the Liberal Party, and we knew there was a lot of potential uranium to be developed in Western Australia. And in other areas, there were key points of difference that we emphasised throughout the campaign. When the campaign started, as I said, I thought a 40% chance of success. But there was a mood in the community for change that I, and I think probably everyone, had underestimated. As I went around into marginal seats, into shopping centres, people came up, slapped me on the back, said, "Good luck, I've always voted Labor, this time I'm voting Liberal." I wasn't quite sure initially why that was, but it was growing. And you do have moments in election campaigns. One moment was the City to Surf Fun Run in the middle of the campaign. Now, I happened to be at Parliament House by chance, preparing for the day's media announcement, and obviously you could not help but notice 40,000 people about to run down St George's Terrace and past the driveway to Parliament House. So I took my tie off, went down there and stood there and simply waved. Now, it's not bad politics when you get 40,000 people running within 10 metres of you over a 40-minute period. What I found extraordinary and didn't expect and have never experienced in my political life were people were cheering. "Good on you, Cole." You know, I think one person yelled out, "Free booze for pensioners," and one person in a very faltering voice said, "Up the Labor Party," and was howled down by the crowd as they all ran past. So the mood was there and it continued to gather. Interestingly enough, the media in Western Australia did not detect that mood throughout the election campaign. Candidates, campaigners on the ground did. We won the election. The count was slow, and we had a difficult period of coming together with an alliance rather than a coalition with the National Party. That took a week, but we got there. And we had slimmest of majorities, one seat. But I want to emphasise that we won that election. We didn't just fall over the line by accident. The Liberal Party won 10 seats off Labor in a 59-seat lower house. We won comfortably in the upper house. The Liberal Party outpolled Labor by 30,000 votes alone, and then you can add the Nationals and the Conservative Independents. As we have gone on over the last year, our position has improved somewhat. There was a by-election in a safe Labor seat of Fremantle. We took the decision not to contest that, and the Greens won it. Not sure how that'll work out in the end, but Labor lost a seat. A former Labor minister who stood and was re-elected as an independent took a decision that he would vote with the National Party, sits on our side of the House, and has kept his word. As recently as a month ago, a young Labor member in the northwest region of the state decided that the Liberal National Government was doing good things in his electorate and he'd like to be part of it, so he defected from Labor and joined the National Party. So on a good day, we now have 32 votes out of 59. The government is certainly more secure than it was a year ago. As a government, we have set some standards in the public sector, standards in terms of conduct of ministers and members of parliament, and an emphasis on making decisions. Every week in the West Australian Cabinet, I say to ministers, your job is to judge the issues that come to you, take the advice, assess it, look at the alternate points of view, but you must make decisions. You must do that. That is your responsibility. And we've been doing that in economic, financial areas, housing, health, education. And we're going to continue to do that to remain what I hope is a good government and judge so to be. The election of our government coincided with, obviously, the global financial crisis. But I have not lost sight of what I take as the three messages that came out of the election. There is no doubt that people voted for a change of government. They also voted very clearly for more to be done in country areas. Not just country voters, but also city voters. And they also voted for more attention, more to be done on the environment. They were the three themes that came through the election campaign. It was interesting, on the environmental issue, the Labor Party, in the last 2 weeks of the campaign, decided to campaign intensely at a local level on an anti-uranium mine position. Now, that might work in Sydney or Melbourne, but it's not going to work in the world's leading mining economy. And it didn't. I think during the whole election campaign, two people came up to me and asked me about uranium mining and basically didn't support it. And one said to me, we much prefer geothermal. And I said, that's nice. But I said, do you realise that in Western Australia, geothermal is radioactive decay? She didn't like geothermal anymore. So it just didn't resonate as an issue. Now, as a government, and I've taken on the responsibility of state development. That is my background during the government of Richard Court. And Western Australia is all about big projects, international trade, large, bold steps forward. Our history, 1890s, the gold boom. The population went from 50,000 to 200,000. The 1960s, with the development of the Pilbara region, iron ore and natural gas to Japan. A relationship that has underpinned our economy for 50 years, and now, obviously, the emergence of modern China and the emergence of India and other nations. There have been these waves of development. There are a number of major projects taking place in Western Australia, and I'm just going to mention them briefly, but I want to talk about more what I think it means nationally and make some comments about what might be going on and what are some of the opportunities and maybe some of the risks we face. Now, I know everyone's been to Western Australia, and I hope I'm not being patronising by putting a map up. Look, Western Australia is a long way away. And if you live or work in Western Australia for any period of time, you realise that not only is it a very isolated state, it is large. Geography and distance impacts on everything in our state. It is 2,400 kilometres north-south, 1,600 kilometres east-west, basically the size of Europe. To get to somewhere takes time, is expensive. The population is only 2.2 million people. 75% of them live in Perth. Ironically, such a large landmass and such a heavily concentrated population in just one city. We are blessed and we are fortunate in an extraordinary natural resource endowment. And I'm not exaggerating in saying that Western Australia is without doubt the world's leading mining economy. Over 50 different minerals produced, significant world market shares, 10% of liquefied natural gas, 15% of iron ore, 10% of nickel, 10% of gold, 35% of titanium, and it goes on and on. They are significant world market shares located in one area. It's a very specialised economy, heavily concentrated on mining, petroleum and farming, and it's a very internationally focused economy. The title of what I was addressing was Over the Nullarbor and Over the Horizon. That's true from this perspective of Sydney. In Western Australia, people for the last 50 years have looked over the horizon to Asia, not over the Nullarbor to Sydney, Melbourne or Canberra. And that is implicit in almost everything that happens, in government, in business, and even down to travel patterns. People will go to Bali rather than go to Rottnest Island. It's cheaper. And that has been there in this West Australian ethos for decades. There is that connection that is stronger than elsewhere in Australia. Now, there is an extraordinary opportunity and an extraordinary number of large projects happening. As a Premier and with my senior staff, I have worked intensely. I've never worked as intensely in my life as getting these projects going. To get the state economy, to the extent it helps Australia, through the global financial crisis, and to get a momentum back into development. Now, I just want to just briefly mention a few spots around the state. Right up there at the top, Kununurra, close to the Northern Territory border. That is the site of the Ord River Dam and the Ord River Irrigation Scheme. The Ord River Dam, some of you may have seen it, is magnificent by the largest freshwater resource in Australia. It contains 18 times the volume of water in Sydney Harbour. When the Ord River and the other river that comes out the other side of the Kimberley, the Fitzroy, flow, and they don't flow all year, they are seasonal, according to the cyclonic conditions, when they are in flood, they are literally of Amazon proportions. This is one of the world's great water resources. And it is a vast area of land. The Kimberley region, that top end of Western Australia, is twice the size of the state of Victoria. To fly across it from Broome to Kununurra in time and distance is the same as flying from Melbourne to Sydney. This is a vast area, it's a pristine environment, small population, 30 to 40,000 people, extraordinary, beautiful and spectacular coastline, well known, appears on the Qantas ad. When it was opened in 1972 by Billy McMahon, he announced that stage two would follow on immediately. Well, it didn't. And there were a lot of problems in agricultural production in that subtropical region. The state and the Commonwealth have, however, reached an agreement on developing Ord Stage 2, which is adding a further 16,000 hectares of irrigation land, more than doubling the size of the project. The state will spend $230 million on extending the irrigation channels, the roads, the bridges, all of that infrastructure, and then sell the land, obviously, to farmers. The Commonwealth will spend about $190 million on improving the social infrastructure, housing, health services, education, training, particularly for Indigenous people, not only around Kununurra, but in that whole broader East Kimberley region. Interesting, a major agricultural project with abundant water and irrigation matched by a major social objective. To see if the two together can provide real opportunities for prosperity, worthy lives and success, personal and business, for Aboriginal people. So it's a great social experiment, hopefully a great social endeavour, I should say, taking place in that area. And I'm confident it will succeed. Going around the Kimberley, there's a place called James Price Point. James Price Point will no doubt become well known in Australian debate in months to come. Off there is a very large natural gas resource called the Browse Basin. Undeveloped, no production from there at all as yet. All of the major companies of the world, petroleum, are exploring and finding gas and oil in that area. The state government, along with the Commonwealth, the state government has decided that gas should be processed in that area at a place called James Price Point, which is about 60 kilometres to the north of Broome. Yes, it is the Kimberley Coast, but it is not the Kimberley Coast that most people would identify with. The area around James Price Point is flat, scrub land. Pristine, unoccupied, but not remarkable. No different than thousands and thousands of square kilometres of similar land. James Price Point has a beach, not remarkable. There are no hills, rugged, spectacular cliffs at James Price Point. In fact, the whole Dampier Peninsula, on which it is a part, is over 200 kilometres long, basically flat. This is not the spectacular Kimberley. That does not say it is unimportant. The impact of an LNG plant will be minimal. This is not an industrial complex, as someone would try and describe. It is basically a large refrigerator. All it does is take natural gas, cool it down to minus 170 degrees centigrade, where it turns into a liquid, its volume's reduced, and it can be exported and contained within shipping. High tech, high sophisticated, very clean. And all that will be there will be this LNG plant, perhaps several of them. The frontage on the coastline will be perhaps a kilometre. The shipping movements, maybe two or three a week, of the most sophisticated commercial shipping in the world. Now, there are concerns raised quite properly and recently about whales. Some spectacular photos of over 160 humpback whales off James Price Point. Great to see. They're thriving. They swim up and back each year. And they don't only swim past James Price Point, they swim past Bunbury, Fremantle Harbour, Geraldton, through all of the massive shipping and frequent movements of the iron ore ships of the Pilbara. And their numbers are 22,000. The whale population on the west coast of Australia has recovered to pre-whaling volume levels. It is one of the world's great migrations, and the numbers are increasing at around 10% per year. So, yes, it's fantastic. Great, extraordinary thing. The LNG industry in the Kimberley will not impact on the whales. There are far more shipping movements in the southern part of the state, which they also swim past, than there will ever be in the Kimberley. And I think it's important that people look objectively at what was bound to be a significant environmental debate in Australia. I recognise that. Coming down the coast to the Pilbara, the project that is attracting a lot of attention now is the Gorgon Natural Gas Project on Barrow Island. Barrow Island is interesting. It's about 60 kilometres long, flat tableland, only rises a couple of metres above the sea, and it is a piece of ancient remnant Australia. And for that reason, as it was cut off from the mainland, species have survived on Barrow Island that exist nowhere else on the world. It is pristine, it is unique in that sense. And ironically, one of the reasons those species have survived in such a pristine state is that the oil industry has been there for 40 years. Chevron. The island has, because of its unique species, flora and fauna, various types of wallabies and goannas and things, because of the unique species, the oil industry has operated on a quarantine basis. Other islands, like the Montebellas and other islands in the area, haven't had the oil industry, haven't had quarantine. Feral rat species and plant species have arrived and basically destroyed the natural habitat. It's interesting. So when Gorgon develops the project, and this is a $50 billion investment to produce 30 million tonnes of LNG, liquefied natural gas, a year, the demands on the quarantining and protection of that island are the most exacting conditions probably put on any project in Australia's history. And it's a massive project. 10,000 people probably employed on the island and on Australia's mainland during construction. There will be 3,500 people on the island itself during construction. Building the accommodation itself will cost $500 million. There is nothing that I think anyone can really come to grips with. And there are other projects. We already have the North West Shelf. There is the Pluto LNG project that has one production train, looking at a second and a third. There are several projects to the north in the Browse Basin. Other projects in the area of the Pilbara Coast include Wheatstone, Macedon, Scarborough. Gorgon might be the biggest, but there are several others of the scale of $20, $30 billion. And the point I make is not to talk so much about an individual project, to make the observation for Australia, we are seeing the emergence of an extraordinary degree of investment and a major new industry sector for the Australian economy. And if I can take a moment just to comment on the gas reserves. Gas is an attractive fuel. It can be used for town gas, through appliances in the home. It can be used for power generation. It can be used for its chemical composition. It's a clean fuel. If you produce electricity from a combined cycle gas plant, it will produce one third to one half of the emissions of an equivalent coal plant. It's clean. For many countries, that's attractive. For many countries also, it's a transition energy source between maybe a coal era and a nuclear era. And it might fill those 20 or 30 years in between. Many of the companies find access to gas reserves around the world now limited. South America, the Gulf region, as state-owned enterprises basically take over those resources. So the world is focusing on this part of Australia. And our gas resource there, we have as a nation, is world-class. This is a world-class resource. And the industry, transporting gas as a liquid, is a relatively young industry. It only began in the 1960s and in Asia Pacific in the 1970s. We currently, as a country, predominantly from Western Australia, a little bit in the Northern Territory, produce 20 million tonnes of LNG a year, which is about 11% of world production. The projections, and I think they are realistic, by 2020, not that far away, Australia could be producing around 60 million tonnes, or around 15% of what world demand is expected to be at that point. This is perhaps the greatest investment wave Australia has ever witnessed. And it's going to bring all sorts of issues with it. And they include, have we got the workforce? Will industrial action become a problem? Will that push construction costs too high? There are all the environmental issues to be managed, a host of factors. And I'm working as a state premier to try and make sure that we maximise the benefits, not only for Western Australia, but for Australia out of this natural resource and the development that's taking place. Coming down the coast, there is another region, in the midwest of the state, to the north of Geraldton. Geraldton is a town of about 35,000 people, 400 kilometres to the north of Perth. There is a mineral province in that area, which is quite rich and diverse, including iron ore. It would have developed had the fabulous resources of the Pilbara not been discovered in the 1960s. Everyone just simply jumped over the Midwest and left it. I have been passionate about trying to develop a deep sea port at a place called Okajie, which is again relatively remote. It's important because it's one of the few places on the West Australian coast where deep water comes in close to the beach. And to have alongside that a world-class industrial estate, rail lines, iron ore, copper, nickel, a whole range of minerals, and hopefully the processing of those into higher value products in that area. When I was a minister in the 1990s looking after the resources industry and I first started to promote this Okajie project, I was handling a lot of prospective industries and developments. And the dream in Western Australia had always been to add more value, to do more, to take the iron ore to steel, to take the natural gas to chemicals, to take the nickel to stainless steel, whatever it might be. And it never really quite worked. We never got there. Made some success story, but never got there. And if you think about it, it was fundamentally flawed. Because what, from the days of Charles Court and others, what people have been trying to do, if you think about it, was to turn a mining company into a manufacturing company, to say to the mining company, go out and compete with your customers, or to turn a petroleum company into a chemical company. It was actually flawed. It's never going to work, and it didn't work. And I came to the realisation, fairly obvious I suppose in hindsight, that what we needed to do was to attract the customers here. And to do that, we needed two things. We need a purpose-built industrial site for them to build their complex, their plant, their processing operation. And we needed low-cost and plentiful energy. And that realisation came to me when there was a project that I was trying to bring together in the 1990s, and we lost it to Trinidad. I can cop losing a project to Canada. I can even cop losing one to Victoria. But I can't cop losing one to Trinidad. And all they had was a very small gas resource, which was the main feedstock for this chemical plant, but they had a purpose-built industrial estate. Now, for companies that are manufacturers and processors and chemical producers, they don't have the ownership of some fabulously wealthy, high-priced natural resource. They are buyers. They don't want to become miners. And Oakajee is a dream about developing the most competitive area for mineral processing in Australia and perhaps the world. That's what it'll be about. And the other part, the more complex part, will be getting the energy price right. But that's what it's all about. And I'm pleased that the Commonwealth Government has joined with the state, and the Commonwealth and the state will jointly own the port side of that operation. The total Oakajee development is about $4 billion. But the port, Australia's West Coast deep sea port, will be government owned and will be operated commercially. The other interesting little thing about Oakajee, it will be the first major project in the resources industry that could be described as genuinely Australian, Japanese and Chinese. It may be a forebearer of other investments and projects to come, quite unique. There are other projects that we're working on. There's a whole lot of things happening, looking at some major city redevelopment, sinking the rail line, a waterfront development, a bit like a Darling Harbour and the like. These are all big things for Western Australia, and it is riding on the emergence of China in particular, and India to a lesser extent. And I want to make a few little comments about our relationship with China. Now, I am not a China expert by any means, and I don't purport to be one. I've been to China several times. I went several times as a minister in the 1990s, working on projects such as these. They all have long, long gestation periods. I happened to be in China in July, coincidentally, at the time at which I think the relationship between Australia and China reached its lowest point. And I don't want to overstate that, but at the same time, I think our relationship is in a serious state and needs a great deal of attention. I was there as the only state premier. Happens to be in the state that is important to China, most important. There to talk about iron ore and natural gas and other projects like Oakajee. The point I would make to begin on China, and it may sound somewhat unpalatable, but I believe it to be true. China is more important to Australia than Australia is to China. We need to get ourselves through that little intellectual hoop. What we produce, which is primarily minerals and agricultural produce, can be bought elsewhere. There's nothing particularly unique or rare about what we produce. Africa has abundant resources. China is a big player in Africa. So we need that little first reality check. When I arrived in China, there were a range of issues that just coincidentally compounded on that week. And I just happened to be, at that time, there, I guess the most senior Australian who happened to be in China. Some of them were commercial, some of them were political. The commercial issues were several. And this is from China's perspective. China saw that Australia was discriminating against China in terms of foreign investment approval. Look, I don't think they are. We are. But that was the China's perception. They also saw that China was allowed to get involved in some of the marginal, smaller mining projects with probably less prestigious partners and certainly low-quality resources, unlike what had happened with Japan. We also had the rather spectacular case of the arrest of Stern Hugh, the Rio Tinto executive, and charges, originally espionage, now something less than that. Obviously a very critical issue. Great apprehension about the proposed merger of BHP and Rio Tinto's iron ore operations. And of course, just before I'd arrived, we had the circumstance where with Rio Tinto in its post-global financial crisis problems, Chinalco, a major state-owned enterprise, equivalent to a top five Fortune 500 company, had agreed to increase its stake from around 8% to around 19% in Rio Tinto, a lifeline. And that, at the last moment, was rejected. That caused great resentment, not so much, I might say, in Chinalco, but certainly in the Chinese government. All of those factors were all concentrated. At the same time, there were some broader issues. Concern about the Dalai Lama, perhaps not that significant in itself. Dalai Lama has come to Australia several times, so that was probably not a significance. But what was significant was the visit to Australia to the Melbourne Film Festival of Rabia Kadia. Now, I don't pretend to understand the rights or wrongs or the intricacies of the situation in China. But if you think about it from a Chinese perspective, 2 or 3 weeks earlier, serious rioting, 300 people killed on both sides of that ethnic dispute. China saw it as Australia welcoming a person they regard as causing insurrection and internal instability. That's how they saw it. They saw it as Australia interfering in their domestic internal problems, and they probably saw it as pretty arrogant of Australia to be commenting in any case. Now, I don't dismiss the human rights issues. I don't dismiss freedom of speech and freedom of reporting. I should never do that. But I don't think we were wise as a country, given the importance of our economic relationship with China. And we can have our own views, but we should not forget it's a one-party communist country. And whenever you go to China, there's always some little thing that happens that reminds you this is not a Western democracy. It's changing, it's evolving. And those issues were there throughout that week. I spent every meeting I went to, and this was heads of the major state-owned enterprises, people such as the mayor of Shanghai, ranked 4 or 5 in the China system, party secretaries, government officials at a pretty high level. Every meeting I began by saying, your investment, Chinese investment, is welcome in Australia, and it's particularly welcome in Western Australia. And I think I succeeded in reassuring, because that was not the view. By the end of the week, I was getting very positive, more than positive, basically commitments to iron ore gas projects based in Western Australia. I don't think that would have happened at the beginning of the week. I have never worked as intensely on an overseas trip as I did during that week in China. And I think one little story summarises the sentiment. This was front page news too. There were headlines, Rio spies, anti-Australian media, probably anti-Australian propaganda, full on throughout Chinese media. Anyone who sits back in Australia and thinks this was some slight aberration, I'm sorry, that it would be a misguided view. This is a serious circumstance in our relationship. And it came to me when I was invited to do an interview with Chinese television. Now, I am only a state premier. I don't expect to be in the Chinese media. I don't expect to be an amateur diplomat, but that was the situation I found myself in. I was interviewed by an elderly Chinese reporter who was described to me as China's equivalent of Parkinson. Similar age, similar style show, and a show that apparently is watched by all the Chinese leadership. He set up a little studio in the hotel to do the interview. When I walked in, he walked up to me and said, "Oh, hello, Mr. Barnett," introduced himself and said, "Over my career, I have interviewed 300 world leaders." And I said to him, "Well, that's very flattering, but I'm hardly a world leader." And he said, "No, but you are this week." And that was the intensity of the China-Australia issue in Beijing at that time. Now, I don't think it's ruined, but this is not something that can be dismissed as just a couple of incidents. It will take Australia to treat China as a special case. We need to show respect to China as we show to America and Japan and to European countries. We need to recognise that China is the most important country to our future over coming decades. And we need to see China not just as a buyer of raw materials, but to be able to enter into a genuine economic partnership. We should be encouraging China not to be involved in aggressive hostile takeover bids for small companies with marginal resources. We should be encouraging China to be shareholders, hopefully minority, but shareholders, significant shares, 10, 15%, whatever it might be, with major partners, Australia's top companies, Europe and America's top companies, on the quality natural resources. Let's lift the relationship. Let's show China the respect that we should. And that was the theme that I developed. And if I can make a comparison in history, the relationship between Australia and Japan was forged in the 1960s, just a decade or so after the end of the Second World War. What an extraordinary environment. And yet we forged this relationship with Japan. My father, he was a rat of Tobruk. He was not happy about it, nor was his generation. But he was convinced, along with others in Western Australia, that our future lay with the post-war reconstruction of Japan, selling iron ore and natural gas. But there was a great deal of thought that went into that relationship, both by the West Australian government, some governments on this side of the country, and the Commonwealth government. And the deal was implicit. Japanese companies, the trading houses, the Mitsuis and the Mitsubishis, the steel mills and the electricity and the gas utilities became foundation investors in quality projects with quality partners. They took small shares in those projects, 16% of the Northwest Shelf project, 5% of something else. And they held those long-term shareholdings to this day. It was a mature relationship and understanding at a government-to-government and at a corporate level that has served both countries well and certainly served development in Western Australia particularly well. And yet here, in the first decade of this century, we get the emergence of China, probably the economic phenomenon of this century. And we have not, as a country, through both Commonwealth and state governments, put the time into the relationship that was put into the relationship with Japan in the 1960s. We have left it up to China to sort of struggle around our resources industry, probably get a lot of bad advice, get involved in some potential projects where it was more about the share price and speculative gains than ever actually mining, getting involved in not quality parties or partners. We need, in my view, as a country, to put a special emphasis into the China relationship, not treat China as just any other country, but make it a special case because of its unique importance. We need some clear policy guidelines through the Foreign Investment Review Board on the relationship with China. And I would suggest it should be similar to the rules we basically laid down with Japan. If we do that, we will do well and we will prosper. Now, I've clearly spoken too long, but I've finished, Jared. So I thank you very much for listening to me.
I came in 10 seconds too early, but I did my best. Many thanks, Premier. Now, we've got till 7 o'clock, so we've got time to have brief answers. A lot of people here, and we'll have brief responses, and we'll be away. Now, can I just ask you firstly, congratulations, it's your first anniversary on Sunday, and of course you're the only Liberal Premier among the states and the territories. So what's your... how do you view COAG? I mean, is it as important as the Prime Minister seems to imply it is? Are you happy with it? Just a brief response on that.
One of the things that surprised me on becoming Premier was the very rapid emergence of the Council of Australian Governments. It used to only meet basically once during the Howard years. In the last year, I have been to 5 COAG meetings. There's another one coming up. It is becoming a very prevalent, very frequent occurrence. And the range of topics being discussed and agreed at COAG is growing very, very quickly. There have certainly been some very good reforms in Commonwealth-State relations. We've gone from something like 90 special purpose payments down to 6 national agreements. That's sensible. But we're also seeing now the growth of beneath that of national partnerships. So far there's about 22, and it's been talked that might get up well over double that. I think COAG works well. There's very little politics in COAG, interesting enough. Maybe there's only one Liberal, that might be the reason. But people basically don't talk politics. It is down to business, and it's looking at trying to improve health and education. I find it cooperative, and I find it effective. Is there a concern? Yes, it is. a body that really doesn't have constitutional or legal standing. It is emerging as a very important and powerful forum in Australian governance. And I'm not sure that it's always the case that what is agreed at COAG has been through state or even maybe federal cabinets, and there's a presumption that it will be accepted, and it's a presumption that parliaments, both federal and state, will go along with what's agreed. It may just get too big for its boots, is what I'm saying. But I have found it, so far, a successful forum, Gerard, but I think there might be some concerns that COAG starts to become this new level of government in Australia, and a very powerful one. So far, it's been good, but I think the jury is still out, and the test might be in the run-up to a federal election.
Thanks. Right down the back. Yeah.
Earlier, you mentioned the
Look, I was leader in a campaign that didn't win in 2005 on a proposal to bring water down the West Australian coast, which sounds a bit fanciful, but the reason that it can actually be done down the West Australian coast is it's flat. Water flows, there are no hills, no mountain ranges, it just flows. That water resource has to be part of Australia's long-term planning and future. For the coming period, perhaps 10, 20 years, I think its use will be primarily in developing irrigation farming in the north, in both the Ord Valley and also the Kimberley Valley. The Fitzroy River Valley. And given the obvious demise of the Murray-Darling system and of irrigation farming along its length, I would hope there's a generation of young Australian irrigation farmers that will move to areas like Kununurra and increase production there. In the long term, if climate change and reduced rainfall continues, particularly in southeastern Australia, I think someone should look at it. There's no doubt it's technically feasible, but it's a problem. And having travelled through China for a while, it is interesting. We spend so much time in Australia agonising over decisions. China, I'm not advocating their political system, but they could make a decision on a high-speed rail line that would basically stretch from London, from Melbourne to Sydney, and build it in 3 years. And that's what's going on. That's what's going on in our part of the world, and we need to realise.
So we're going well with short questions and short answers, so let's continue. Then we'll go back to Larry Anthony.
Do you see any difference between investment by publicly listed Japanese, US, European companies in resources and investment in those sort of resources by state-owned companies from China or any other state?
Yes, I do. And obviously, as a Liberal leader, would always like to think capitalism's alive and strong and the market's there. The reality, though, in our part of the world is that sovereign wealth funds are increasingly important, Singapore, Gulf region. The other reality is that while China now has 50% private enterprise, the industries that matter, certainly to Western Australia, big heavy industry and the large financial institutions and the large commodity traders are all state-owned enterprises. So we have to come to grips with that reality of dealing with them. Not all that different in some respects from the trading houses and Japanese government-backed investment of the 1960s. I think we've got to come to grips with that. I was probably more worried about it a couple of years ago, but here we are. And given the global financial crisis, President Obama is now a reluctant owner of several banks and a couple of car companies. So it's a different world we live in. And I think capitalism wound back a decade or two last year.
Sorry, Anthony.
Premier, I was wondering whether you could explain to the audience just your view currently on the big debate in Canberra at the moment, which is ETS and the CBRS, which we've voted on in a couple of months. In particular, what public impact that is having on future projects in Western Australia, obviously a major announcement recently, but have you seen the ramifications for investment in Western Australia and therefore?
It certainly is a substantial risk if it's not done the right way. Many of the projects and many of the future projects which add more value by processing minerals will by definition be energy intensive. So we could it won't affect things like LNG, but mineral processing could be affected. If the dream of getting iron ore into steel is still there, that could be a lot harder. Look, I have a pretty simplistic view of emission trading schemes. I think they are part of the solution to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The idea of a market mechanism has got a natural appeal and it will play a role. But look, if you step back and look at it, it's an indirect method of dealing with the issue. It's passive. It relies on market forces. Now that sounds great, but why wouldn't you take direct measures? Why rely on an indirect, imperfect market mechanism that can be highly disruptive and highly expensive to industry and consumers through electricity prices when there might be some simple direct measures? And I'll give you one example. Yes, it's got a West Australian bias. Our natural gas resource, world quality. It's Australia's resource, it's not mine, it's ours. Massive natural resource, largest underdeveloped resource in Asia Pacific. The rest of the world's buying it, we're not using it. Why wouldn't you, for example, take a simple policy decision that half or maybe more of new power generation in Australia would be natural gas? If you did that, you'd probably reduce greenhouse emissions by 5 to 10% and it would be costless. I'm not saying get rid of coal, I'm not saying phase coal out, I'm saying just make a decision to use more natural gas. Now there is gas on the eastern seaboard, Bass Strait, there's coal seam methane proposals and the like, but it's a small amount. 90% of Australia's gas resource is off the northwest coast. The resource over here is limited. It's useful, it's valuable, it's limited. But there is, you know, Australia is not looking strategically at this resource. This is of strategic significance, not only to us, but in the Asia-Pacific region. Other countries recognise that. We don't seem to. And I would much rather we do things like that, make a policy decision to use more natural gas, rather than impose an expensive, complex, unpredictable emissions trading scheme. I'd much rather see a very low-level ETS come in, a low-level carbon tax, and let it evolve gradually. In fact, it will be an internal shock to our economy. I don't think we need to do that.
No, it doesn't.
And I'm married to a Sydney girl, so. I think the separation from the rest of Australia and the distance factor is real. And that has its own social implications too. And it's certainly true that West Australians, I think, are better connected to China and to Japan and to India. But look, the population is very fluid, and I would hope out of some of these major resources projects that we see large numbers of young Australians with skills move across and work on them. I hope many of them stay, but it's a great opportunity for people to go and work in some fairly remote but now fairly comfortable locations, earn a lot of money, probably buy and pay off their house in 3 years. And it's important that we spread the benefits of these projects across the country.
Congratulations, we have to spread the disease east.
I'm trying.
Still think you'll have the tyranny of distance, Asia up there, the rest of us over here, and even in your own state, in many, many aspects.
It's impossible to do anything in Western Australia and not be affected by distance. And the harshness of the environment. If you take the Pilbara region around Karratha, you know, that area, I mean, it is extraordinarily harsh. 45, 50 degree temperatures in summer. Very barren landscape. Now, what's an interesting little observation is that when the Pilbara was developed in the 60s, the governments and the industry of the day basically tried to replicate Perth suburbs in the Pilbara. Three bedroom, one bathroom, backyard, hills hoist. I mean, and it hasn't worked all that well. These towns are not attractive places to live in. the infrastructure that's built is now old and crumbling. And one part of the developments that are taking place is that we as a government, with the property industry, are planning to do what has actually happened in Darwin and to build apartment towers, 10, 15, 20 storey towers on the ocean. Sydney-style apartments, air-conditioned, green lawns around them, swimming pools and tennis courts, and undercover parking for your four-wheel drive and your boat. And we need to provide that, along with far better education, far more accessible and quality health services. We need to make this remote part of Australia not only a great generator of wealth, we need to make it a great place for people to live and work in. And we haven't done that well as a country, or as a, and primarily that responsibility is Western Australia. We have not done that well. What happened in the 60s is no longer acceptable 50 years on. And as a state, we've allocated $300 million to that purpose. Kevin Rudd's offered us $100 million a year out of Gorgon. That will go into that program as well.
Final question down here.
Thank you for your comments on China. I was interested in your comments on India and the market opportunities for construction.
Yes, India's development is obviously different than China. I don't think they should just be lumped together as two parallel economies. There is increasing Indian investment in Western Australia. Interestingly enough, in high value adding, because of the abundance of natural gas, there is one plant, about $1 billion investment, operational now, producing urea fertiliser. They are proposing a bigger expansion, and then there is another project similar. They are projects backed by the Indian government for the very sensible reason that India needs to improve its food production, and to do that it needs vast volumes of fertiliser and needs to distribute that to villages and agricultural areas throughout India. So the India relationship is certainly behind China in a sense with Australia, but growing quickly. And one other observation about that, post the global financial crisis, and with sovereign wealth funds and the differing stages of economic development of the various countries and their differing political systems, I suspect we will see over the coming decade a far more direct involvement of governments here, both state and federal, and governments overseas on major sort of trading deals and relationships. It's not what I might philosophically advocate, but it's happening. For example, I went to Japan, first trip overseas as a premier. Foreign Minister, or then Foreign Minister Nakasone, made the comment to me, Japan is unhappy about its imported food supply. People, consumers, are worried about where it comes from, the conditions of animal welfare, the standards of the products. And he said quite bluntly, we don't buy anywhere near enough food from Australia. The implication was that Japan would want to buy perhaps two or three times in the future from Australia what it buys now. The Gulf region, very wealthy from its oil revenues, a couple of years ago realised they could not feed their population. If there was one thing that will depose a sheikh, is if the people are hungry. Those countries, Saudi Arabia in particular, are looking to Australia to provide millions of tonnes of wheat additional and probably stop their own wheat production. It's hard work, it's expensive work trying to grow wheat in the desert under irrigation. So you're getting these big structural changes. I think, you know, for those who studied a bit of economics, we're out of, for a moment, we're out of sort of marginal changes. We're in an era of discrete, large geopolitical changes that will affect industry and the structure of industry within Australia.
Waiting then, I'm afraid to take one last question. Don't be afraid.
What are your views on the proposed transaction between
the Indian
government and the Indian government? This is the third attempt at it. First was in 99, the second in 2007, and now 2008-09. As a former minister who had responsibility for the iron ore resource, I opposed it, and I am still unhappy about it. My major concern was that it would put the Pilbara iron ore resource in the hands of one company, and that has a policy implication for Western Australia. It also has a commercial interest. That iron ore belongs to the people of Western Australia. We have a commercial interest in making sure that the price is maximised and development proceeds well. So sometimes that's forgotten by industry. Governments have both policy and commercial interests. Look, I've taken the approach this time around for a range of reasons that we will not be obstructionist as a government. BHP and Rio cannot do this unless the state government agrees. But we're not going to be stupid about that. I think also we've seen a change in the last 2 years with the emergence of mid-sized miners like FMG, and there are a host of smaller iron ore producers both in the Pilbara and in the Midwest region near Okajee. So that share of the resource is changing a little bit. There will be a price, if you like, and that will relate to the royalty paid by a merged entity on the iron ore. It will relate to the payment of a stamp duty or stamp duty equivalent, depending on the legalities, and it will relate to access to the rail infrastructure to the smaller companies. So that's where we're at. Had a meeting with Marius Kloppers a couple of days ago, and we agreed we'd meet again.
Take a seat.
Thank you.
It's great to have Colin Barnett across in the Eastern State. He's a busy man, and Western Australia is a long way away, but it's good to have him here. And no doubt, I know he's spending time here, no doubt he'll spend more time here. But what we've seen today is a very impressive analysis of, in a sense, Australia's importance to the world and Western Australians' importance to the rest of Australia, and we've seen both of those exhibited today in the speech. So, well done, Premier. Congratulations on your first anniversary of your victory, and no doubt we'll see you back in the future with your very important message about Australia in general and Western Australia in particular. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again.